Did you know that Nika AATC offers self-paced online courses on a growing range of topics aimed at helping you improve health outcomes for people with HIV? These interactive courses can typically be completed in about an hour and cover multidisciplinary topics such as smoking cessation in people with HIV, geriatric assessment and integration and models of care, managing difficult behaviors in HIV care settings, and using Zoom as a virtual workspace. Self-paced online courses are offered on Rise, Nika AATC's online learning platform. Courses are designed for healthcare providers providing patient care for people with HIV, including physicians, physician assistants, nurses, pharmacists, case managers, outreach workers, and other disciplines. To explore online courses for HIV care professionals, navigate to www.nikaatc.org/rise-courses. That's www.nikaatc.org/RISE-courses, or click the link in the podcast episode description. Welcome to Nika in the Know, a podcast for healthcare providers in the HIV field. I'm Mariana Braven. Today, I'm sitting down with Dr. Robert Remian to talk about behavioral health along the HIV care continuum. Dr. Remian is Nika AATC's Clinical Director of Behavioral Health and the Director of the HIV Center for Clinical and Behavioral Studies at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and Columbia University. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Remian.
Thank you, Mariana. I'm really happy to be here.
So let's just dive right in and start by talking about the early days of HIV in the 80s and 90s. What can you tell us about the treatment options that were available at the time and the toll it took on people with HIV in terms of mental health?
Well, yeah, in the early days, it was very challenging. This epidemic started a lot of people will say it predates even the 80s, but when it came to our attention, we started seeing it in the public world. It was in the very early 80s. And for the first 15 years of the epidemic, we didn't have truly effective treatment for people living with HIV. And so for a lot of people, the majority of people, not everyone, it was what people called a death sentence. And so what we were dealing with in the community and in our clinical settings was a lot of morbidity and mortality, a lot of illness, a lot of comorbid illnesses, what we call opportunistic infections, because the immune system was declining with time. And it was just visible in communities. So we had multiple loss in families and communities and in social networks. And there was also a great deal of stigma. There was out and out discrimination. People were afraid of the disease early on. As we began to learn things, we started to develop what we knew as behavioral prevention, which fell into things like having to reduce partners or use, sex always being protected with some kind of barrier. So those were the challenges. And I'm speaking as a psychologist to you, those of us who were involved early in the epidemic. As a psychologist, I was dealing with communities and patients and families that were dealing, again, with multiple loss, with illness, with death and dying. And those were the challenges until we had effective combination therapy that came into place around 1996.
And how have some of these things changed in recent years? What can you tell us about advancements in HIV prevention and treatment?
Well, the great advances have been both on the treatment side and on the prevention side. So as I was just talking about treatment, because it was so devastating and the majority of people progressed to serious illness and were dying, when effective combination therapy came out, that's when people's lives were saved. And so it no longer was seen necessarily as a death sentence. I mean, it's still a very serious disease to get HIV, but it was not a death sentence and started to improve and restore the immune system. So on the treatment side, we have effective combination therapy. And over the years, with the various options of treatments and medications, they become less toxic and having fewer side effects. So that people living with it, people diagnosed now with HIV, they really can live what's closer to a normal lifespan because of the effective treatment with not a lot of toxic side effects. So that's on the treatment side. Now, on the prevention side, what's also been developed in the last 15 years or so, and we're still getting new methods of administration of what's called PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. So this protects people who are not living with HIV. It protects them from acquiring HIV. What was first shown to be effective was a daily dosing of an oral medication. So it's really taking a pill every day for people who are sexually active and can potentially be exposed to HIV. It's highly, highly effective in preventing them from acquiring HIV. What we now have is also some people use it episodically during periods of sexual activity so that they don't necessarily take a pill every day. But with also the advances we have and that we're continuing to have are what's called long-acting injectables. So people are getting injections of medication that's for PrEP that they don't have to take a pill, an oral dosing every day. They can get an injection, and it varies, and it's always progressing the science of whether it's 1 month and they're moving towards longer, long-acting, 2 months, 3 months. And the same is true on the treatment side. There are people now who are able to get an injection of their antiretroviral treatment, the treatment for HIV, and not have to take pills every day, but just do long-acting injectable, and they're good for several months. And so these are the advances. And because of these advances, it's really led to a global movement of what we call ending the HIV epidemic. It's aspirational, but it really could happen. Since we have such good biological tools, if you think about it, and our treatment and our clinical approaches have become what's called HIV status neutral. So that for communities and networks and populations, there really is something for everyone, whether or not you're living with HIV. If you're not living with HIV, there are ways of protecting yourself and staying HIV negative. And because of the PrEP that I'm talking about, and because people living with HIV, it's the movement is towards getting on treatment as quickly as possible once someone finds out they have HIV. That restores their health and keeps them from their immune system from declining. It also, this is where it can, even treatment for people living with HIV comes into play and mixes with prevention. When someone living with HIV has a sustained suppressed viral load, they are really unable to transmit HIV to their sexual partners. So there's the phrase that's out there. There's a whole active campaign called U equals U. Uninfectious means untransmittable, right? So that if you, again, suppress viral load and it's good for the person living with HIV to stay healthy, it also will protect their partners by sustaining a suppressed viral load. And then you've got treatment prevention on the other side. So all of this is saying that with these two things combined, we really can end the epidemic and bring incidence down to a level that would be so low that it really would die out in a community or a population. So you can expand that from neighborhood to city, to state, to country, to global efforts to really end this epidemic. It's aspirational. There are unfortunately a lot of inequities. Not everybody is getting treatment appropriately or sustained on treatment. And so we have a lot of work to do in the field to get towards an ending of this epidemic.
So what do we know about the current population of people with HIV, and why is it so important to focus on mental health in the context of HIV prevention and care?
Well, what we do know is there are populations that are more vulnerable to both acquiring HIV and also having poor health outcomes once living with HIV. And there's a lot of vulnerabilities that come into play, but one of the primary ones, And I think it's why you're talking with me today. A lot of the work that I and colleagues of mine do is to focus on behavioral health broadly, and that's the mental health and well-being of the population. So that people not living with HIV, if they have serious mental illness or ongoing untreated a mental disorder, mental illness, they're really at 2 to 3 times the risk of acquiring HIV than a person in the general population not dealing with a mental health disorder. So there's a risk for acquiring, and we're talking about particularly serious and persistent mental illness, but even people with intractable mood disorders and or substance use disorders. And we talk about the comorbidity of mood disorders and substance use disorders. And also there's a lot of history of trauma and traumatic events from childhood into adult trauma or interpersonal violence or abuse that also contributes to someone acquiring HIV. So again, on both on both sides of the equation, a lot of my comments are what we call an HIV status neutral. There's elevated rates of mental health problems and disorders. And so there may be mental health problems and symptomatology that don't rise to the level of a disorder. But these are elevated, again, in people vulnerable to acquiring HIV, and also definitely a lot of research and a lot of data, epidemiological data, shows us that in populations of people living with HIV and HIV clinics, that there are elevated rates of particularly mood disorders, substance use disorders, and post-traumatic stress disorders for these populations. And so what I'm talking about in part is that I feel that if we don't address those things, because these interfere with people's HIV physical health outcomes, they interfere with what we call steps in the prevention and treatment cascades in terms of getting access to PrEP and successfully taking PrEP, but also successfully being on ART, on medication for treatment, and sustaining a viral load. When mental health disorders come into play, people fall off their treatments. They don't do as well with their treatments. And then they also, so it affects HIV outcomes and gets in the way of our ability to end the HIV epidemic. And there are also more broadly, mental health is definitely where I'm focused, but more broadly, we have a lot of what we call social determinants of health and health disparities. So that includes things like food insecurity or unstable housing. And these have an interplay with mental health problems. We know a lot of our homeless population, for instance, are dealing with mental health problems. So here's the interplay of more broadly social determinants of health and very specifically behavioral health.
You mentioned some mental illnesses and disorders. Can you tell us which are the most common in the context of HIV?
Yes. The most common and the most studied and researched in the context of HIV is depression. And we see, you know, all kinds of depression that are more prevalent, definitely among people who are living with HIV. And that's a little bit of a cause and effect that I'll talk about in a minute in terms of, you know, behavioral and biological factors. But the other ones are comorbid alcohol and other substance use disorders, other recreational substances, also anxiety disorders and post-traumatic stress disorders or symptomatology of post-traumatic stress. And then we also are unfortunately seeing elevated rates of HIV-related symptomatic cognitive disorders and things like increased pain and insomnia, which are associated with mental health problems and mental health symptomatology. So I would say depression, substance, anxiety, and trauma-like conditions are the most common are elevated among both people at risk for acquiring HIV and those people actually living with HIV.
So you talked about depression being the most prevalent mental health condition in HIV. Can you tell listeners more about some of the potential biological and behavioral pathways between mental illness like depression and HIV health outcomes?
Yes, this can get very complex and layered. So I'll talk about it briefly. I am not a medical expert. I'm not trained medically, but as a clinical psychologist, I've come to appreciate the interplay of biological factors associated with more behavioral or cognitive or mood factors, and they're really intertwined. And so the fact that HIV itself is a virus that crosses the blood-brain barrier and therefore affects the central nervous system and the brain. And so we have an interplay, and we have evidence, research evidence, that people living with HIV with untreated depression in particular have higher vulnerability to increased mortality, even when they're on life-saving medication for HIV. So there seems to be something at a biological substrate of depression that can also influence physical health and physical outcomes. So again, the interplay of depression and the interplay of the biology of depression, the biology of HIV. And then you throw in that a lot of people at risk for acquiring HIV or living with HIV may be also susceptible to other sexually transmitted infections that also can increase the risk of an STI. Sexual transmitted infection can increase the risk of acquiring HIV because of what's happening at the mucosal level. So it's not just the behavior of having lots of partners, but it's at the site of entry that these viruses can work synergistically. So I'm a little bit, talking all over the place in terms of both STIs, depression, HIV, and having this interplay of biology, behavior, and the epidemiology, meaning the networks within which people are having their sexual activities. And all of these can contribute to acquisition of STIs, HIV, and immune suppression, and then poorer health outcomes among people living with HIV because of what's happening physically, biologically, and also behaviorally when people are not adhering well to their treatments because of things like anxiety, depression, trauma in their lives, or substance abuse or substance dependence, which can interfere with adherence to treatment and care. So there's an inter again, there's an interplay between all of these factors.
So, what mental health screening tools are out there and available for healthcare providers?
Well, there's a really wide range of mental health screening tools, and they're readily available. And they're really relatively easy to use. A screening tool is meant to capture a larger group of people than might actually have, for instance, a mental health disorder. And but you want to what I always advocate for is the use of routine screening in all of primary care, but also in prevention care. So I'm talking about the HIV status neutral approach for people using PrEP, but also people getting regular primary care for their HIV disease, that there should routinely be a check-in or a screening on people's their mood and their use of substances in particular. And so these screening tools are very brief. They're easy to use. They can be administered by non-professionals. In other words, it doesn't take a mental health expert to administer a screening tool. They can even be self-administered. Some people can, patients can fill them out while they're sitting in the waiting room, and then the results can go to their provider that they're going to see in a few minutes. And it picks up on something that if someone is elevated on a screening tool, for instance, for depression, for anxiety, for alcohol use, substance use, for trauma-like or post-traumatic stress-like symptoms or symptomatology, or even cognitive screening and quick cognitive screening to see if there's maybe something going on in terms of one's mentation or thinking, that if you see a little bit of alert, that's a red flag for potential further follow-up that might have to be done by a mental health expert. But again, the point of screening is to use ones that are, they're free, they're available in clinical settings. They, if you do it routinely, people don't feel singled out, particularly if you're going to be asking questions, for instance, about use of substances or alcohol. If providers do this routinely with all of their patients, patient doesn't have to feel singled out. Like, why are you asking me about my substance use? If we normalize it and say, people use substances, people use alcohol, people use tobacco, let's talk about your use, how often, in a very neutral, non-judgmental way. Same thing, I'm concerned, just like I'm concerned about your heart and whether you're having any pain and your breathing, I'm also concerned about your mood. How have you been feeling? And then I can ask a few of the screening questions for depression and anxiety. Again, routinizing these things, making it part of normal care, because someone may not have a mental health problem at one visit, but 6 months later, something can change in their lives and something may pop up. So again, routinizing the screening, non-judgmental, and think about who in the clinical setting can administer these screening tools, so it's not taking a lot of time out of the primary care provider, but someone else on the staff or a self-filled out assessment form can be used.
What are some of the different mental health treatments available that providers can offer? You know, how can providers help close this mental health treatment gap?
Well, you know, it's not really different from treating anyone in the general population. And so, in other words, all of the evidence-based treatments that we have in the mental health field, from psychopharmacological, in other words, use of psychotropic medications, usually given by psychiatrists, sometimes primary care providers can prescribe, but all the range of psychotherapies, from psychodynamic, cognitive behavioral, motivational enhancing therapy, interpersonal therapy, and even things like stress reduction and mindfulness interventions or harm reduction interventions, as well as abstinence treatments for people dealing with substance use challenges. All of these things that are evidence-based in the world for the general population, across cultures, across languages, these are all available. And there's been a movement in recent years, and particularly in more resource-constrained settings, to have some of these treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy or stress reduction interventions to be manualized, or use of even apps for mindfulness interventions, that these can be more broadly administered and used. So again, the short answer is all of the available treatments for mental health are equally as effective for people coping with and living with HIV. So there doesn't have to be a different kind of treatment. And what we do see is that if we pay attention to mental health problems and symptoms, and we get in there and routinely screen and offer treatment for people living with HIV, we do see ultimately intervening with poor adherence to treatment and care, so that people are doing better and actually having better physical outcomes, helping them achieve a reduction in their viral load, suppressing their viral load and sustaining that suppression, and doing well physically and their HIV health outcomes.
As we begin to wrap up, what are some of the benefits to integrating mental health screening and treatment into HIV care?
Well, again, like I said, is I think some of the benefits include, first of all, destigmatizing mental health treatment and care, and even asking questions, right? Unfortunately, the populations I'm talking about and that those of us who work in the HIV field are dealing with are what we call intersecting stigmas, because there still is stigma around HIV. There's stigma around people's certain people's sexual behavior or being of a minority sexual, gender minority status or sexual orientation minority status. And also there's out and out stigma around certain ethnic and racial groups. We still have racism. And so people feel like they're stigmatized in the multiple ways, people who use substances. And people who, for instance, have had to exchange sex for money or for housing or for food, these are things that come with stigma. So mental health itself has stigma. So back to the point I made earlier, if we think about screening people in a routine way, in a non-judgmental way, to check on their mood, check on their substance use, their alcohol use, check on potential trauma or violence in their lives. That's a starting point. And the benefits are that you're treating the person as a whole. And if you really truly integrate behavioral health or mental health care with primary care, now we're talking about HIV primary care, but one can generalize this to all of primary care, right? If we treated people more holistically and treated their mind and their well-being along with their body and how their body is functioning, I think there are potential benefits in terms of their overall health outcomes, as well as, you know, like I said, sort of normalizing and destigmatizing, paying attention to one's mental health and well-being, because we're really talking about people on the spectrum of, you know, having mild or moderate symptoms of mental health problems to more seriously and persistently mental health and having disorders that require a higher level of care and treatment. And providers on the front line can be the first step in sort of paying attention to and recommending things for people to take better care of their mental health and to improve their well-being.
Dr. Romian, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the importance of mental health when it comes to people with HIV. We really hope you learned something new today. To learn more about NECA AATC's work and our role in ending the HIV epidemic, visit us at www.necaaatc.org. That's www.necaaatc.org. If you have questions or comments about anything we covered today, or if you have suggestions for topics you'd like to hear us talk about, don't hesitate to email us at podcast@necaaatc.org. That's podcast@necaaatc.org. Stay safe, and we'll see you on Thursday for our next episode of NECA in the Know. This presentation is supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by, HRSA, HHS, or the U.S. government.